I want you to know that everything I say tonight will be on the level. Speaking of which, Thomas, that is not a banister. That is a chin-up bar for three-year-olds.
Oh.
I've been spending way too much time around Jim Oliver. I thought you'd say I've not been spending enough time. Has something strange ever occurred in your life? Something that's been so strange that you really just could not explain it? An angel of the Lord came to Gideon, and he said to him, "Go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. I will be with you, and you will strike down all the Midianites together." But Gideon was not a warrior. Nevertheless, after God proved his power to him, Gideon went out and gathered the army of Israel, and he headed toward the Midianite camp. The Bible tells us that the forces that were gathered against Israel were as thick as locusts. Their camels could no more be counted than the sand on the seashore. This army was vast. It wasn't just the Midianites. It was their allies gathered with them. The writer is trying to tell us that this number of people was countless. It was such a large army that they couldn't even count the camels, much less the people. But God did something strange. He reduced Gideon's army from a huge number down to just 300 men. And he did so, he said, in order that Israel may not boast against me that her own strength has saved her. Can you imagine yourself in Gideon's position? You are not a general. You are not a trained warrior. You know nothing about going to war. You know nothing about military strategy. God has just reduced your army from tens of thousands down to 300, and you're going out to face an army so vast it cannot even be numbered. What happens next is told in Judges chapter 7 and verses 16 on through 21. Dividing the 300 men into three companies, Gideon placed trumpets and empty jars in the hands of all of them with torches inside. "Watch me," he told them. "Follow my lead. When I get to the edge of the camp, do exactly as I do. When I and all who are with me blow our trumpets, then from all around the camp, blow yours and shout, 'For the Lord and for Gideon!'" Gideon and the 100 men with him reached the edge of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, just after they had changed the guard. They blew their trumpets and broke the jars that were in their hands. The three companies blew the trumpets and smashed the jars. Grasping the torches in their left hands and holding in their right hands the trumpets they were to blow, they shouted, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon!" While each man held his position around the camp, all the Midianites ran, crying out as they fled. What we read next is that absolute chaos broke out, and in the darkness, these Midianites and all their allies with them began striking out at one another, killing one another. They were just scared literally to death. They thought an army even larger than their own had surrounded them and was about to mark them down. And so, with God's encouraging promise, Gideon acted on faith. It was not on past ability. It was not on knowledge. It was not on skill. It was not the size of the army. Gideon acted on faith. He and his 300 men, armed only with trumpets, jars, and torches, were given victory by God over the Midians. How do you explain that? God provides to accomplish his purposes. That's all you can say. In 1 Kings chapter 17 and in verse 9, God told his prophet Elijah, "Go at once to Zarephath of Sidon and stay there. I have commanded a widow in that place to supply you with food." And what happens next is recorded in verses 10 through 16. So he went to Zarephath. When he came to the town gate, a widow was there gathering sticks. He called her and asked, "Would you bring me a little water in a jar so I may have a drink?" As she was going to get it, he called, "And bring me, please, a piece of bread." "As surely as the Lord your God lives," she replied, "I don't have any bread, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug. I'm gathering a few sticks to take home and make a meal for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die." Elijah said to her, "Don't be afraid. Go home and do as you have said. But first, make a small cake of bread for me from what you have and bring it to me, and then make something for yourself and your son. For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says, 'The jar of flour will not be used up, and the jug of oil will not run dry until the day the Lord gives rain on the land.'" She went away and did as Elijah had told her. So there was food every day for Elijah and for the widow and her family. For the jar of flour was not used up, and the jug of oil did not run dry, in keeping with the word of the Lord spoken by Elijah. This whole situation is just strange. God told Elijah to go to a city and depend upon a widow for food. Now, there's widows in this congregation that we could go to and they would provide us with a banquet. But a widow in that time was a person largely without means. And God tells Elijah to go and depend upon a widow for food. But God knew this woman's situation. And moreover, God knew what he would do to show his love and his power. And yet, when you think about what's going on here, with this just a little bit of flour and a little bit of oil, and it continues to provide food for them day after day after day, how do you explain what God did? How did he do it? The only answer is that God provides to accomplish his purposes. In Matthew chapter 14, in verses 13 through 21, Jesus fed 5,000 people with five small pieces of bread and two fish. In the next chapter, Matthew 15, and verses 29 through 39, Jesus fed 4,000 people with seven small pieces of bread and a few small fish. Both times, everyone ate until they were full. And both times, Jesus' followers picked up baskets of leftovers. How did Jesus do that? How do we explain how God used only trumpets and jars and torches to overcome a vast army? How do we explain how God prevented a jar of flour and a jug of oil from not being used up despite their daily use? How do we explain how Jesus used a handful of bread and fish to feed thousands of people? There's only one answer. God provides to accomplish his purposes. About to enter the promised land, Moses gave this reminder to Israel in Deuteronomy chapter 6 and in verses 10 through 12. When the Lord your God brings you into the land he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give to you, a land with large, flourishing cities you did not build, houses filled with all kinds of good things you did not provide, wells you did not dig, and vineyards and olive groves you did not plant. Then, when you eat and are satisfied, be careful that you do not forget the Lord who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You think about this. God is saying to them, everything that you're going to have in this land is nothing that you did anything to provide for yourselves. I am providing all of it for you. I love you. You are my people, my family. I want you to have the best. So I'm providing for you the best land with the best cities, with the best houses, with the best wells, with the best of everything. I am providing it for you, not you. You couldn't do this. I'm providing it for you. Moses reinforced that by reminding them two chapters later in Deuteronomy 8 and in verses 2 through 4. Remember how the Lord your God led you all the way in the desert these 40 years to humble you and to test you in order to know what was in your heart, whether or not you would keep his commands. He humbled you, causing you to hunger, and then feeding you with manna, which neither you nor your fathers had known, to teach you that man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. Your clothes did not wear out, and your feet did not swell during these 40 years. There's a lot of husbands who wish the Lord would act on their wives like this, so that their clothes wouldn't wear out and their feet wouldn't swell. God further promised over in chapter 11 of Deuteronomy and in verses 13 through 15, so if you faithfully obey the commands I'm giving you today, to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, then I will send rain on your land in its season, both autumn and spring rains, so that you may gather in your grain, new wine, and oil. I will provide grass in the fields for your cattle, and you will eat and be satisfied. Now think about all of these things that God promised to provide and did provide. But then think further with me. In addition to all of this, God provided Israel. God provided Israel with great godly leaders. He provided Israel with the best law that any people have ever had. He provided Israel with a land flowing with milk and honey, the promised land. They could not have won it without him. He told them ahead of time that he would go ahead of them. They were just the cleanup crew. God provided Israel with judges, men who delivered them from their enemies. God provided Israel with priests and with prophets to guide them in his ways. God provided them with everything they had. God provided them with everything they needed. God provided them with everything beyond even what they needed. Why? God provides to accomplish his purposes. God provides us today with everything we need. Job observed that God provides food in abundance. Jesus assures us that if we seek first God's kingdom and His righteousness, that He will provide us with what we need for life. 1 Timothy 6, verse 17, urges us as Christians to put our hope in God. Why? Because He richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Can you explain how God does this? I can't accept that this is the substance of faith. Hebrews 11 and verse 1 tells us, now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. Our faith is in a being we do not and cannot see, God. Our faith is in what others have said about their experience with God. We're led to believe in God in largest part because of what we read in the pages of this Bible. It's the witness of people who've walked with God, who've experienced God, who've been shocked by God, confronted by God, used by God, blessed by God, chastened by God. God has proven repeatedly that He has the power to provide. And so over and over the Bible shows us that God provides to accomplish His purposes. He can powerfully provide for our needs because of who He is and because of the relation of the universe to Him. Psalm chapter 50 and verses 7 through 12 has God reminding all humanity of these things. Hear, O my people, and I will speak, O Israel, and I will testify against you. I am God, your God. I do not rebuke you for your sacrifices or your burnt offerings, which are ever before me. I have no need of a bull from your stall or of goats from your pens, for every animal of the forest is mine, and the cattle on a thousand hills. I know every bird in the mountains, and the creatures of the field are mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world is mine and all that is in it. God owns everything. Everything. God has control over everything. Without limits, without exceptions, without exclusions. From that, God can provide anything and everything. He can provide it anywhere, anytime, to anyone in order to accomplish His purposes. That's mind-boggling, isn't it? But when we say that God is the creator of all the universe, and when we say that God is the sustainer of all the universe, when we say that God designed everything that exists, when we say that the mind of God is the thing that gave life to this world, then why is it too hard for us to understand that God owns everything, everything belongs to Him, that God has control over everything, and God can do anything and everything with everything He owns, because everything is His? Deuteronomy chapter 10 and verse 14 tells us, to the Lord your God belong the heavens, even the highest heavens, the earth and everything in it. Job 12 and verse 13 says, to God belong wisdom and power, counsel and understanding are His. And in verse 16 he says, to Him belong strength and victory. Psalm 47, verse 9 reminds us, the kings of the earth belong to God. It's no wonder then that in Psalm 95 and verses 1 through 5, you and I have an urging that comes from a writer who understands these things about God, who has pondered on them, and who has had that great aha moment when he says, "Come, let us sing for joy to the Lord. Let us shout aloud to the rock of our salvation. Let us come before him with thanksgiving and extol him with music and song. For the Lord is the great God, the great King above all gods. In his hand are the depths of the earth, and the mountain peaks belong to him. The sea is his, for he made it, and his hands formed the dry land. Come, let us bow down and worship. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture, the flock under his care." A father trained his toddler son to waddle across the dining room table from one end to the other, and then to jump into his father's arms. One evening, the family had several guests over, and the father, proud as he was of his little toddler son, decided to show them how his son had learned to do this. And so he did it several times, and then, with an even greater amount of pride, the father says, "Now wait." And he went over and he turned the light out. And the people there were nervous about this. They thought, this is just taking things too far. This is abusive. But they heard this little toddler running tap, tap, tap across the table. And all of a sudden they heard this squeal of joy as he went flying in the air and was caught by his father. This little boy had learned to trust his father so much in the light that he trusted him in the dark. He trusted him when he could see him, when things were good. But when things went dark, he trusted him still, because he knew his father would always be there to catch him. In the same way, you and I need to learn to trust our Father God, who always provides to accomplish his purposes. An old German proverb says, "Begin to weave, and God will provide the thread." This is an act of faith, pure and simple. If there is something God wants us to do, our job is to begin it in the faith that if it's God's will, he will provide the way for us to accomplish it. We have a great challenge before us right now as a congregation. The challenge of hiring another full-time minister and doing so as quickly as we can in order to reach souls in our community. We're tapped out here. We need that kind of help. We need it now because there's a ready harvest. It's growing larger all the time. We need to grow with it. Of all the things, though, that we need to think about is our faith. Will we trust in what we have, in the things that we can immediately see, and in the things we think that we can do? Or will we trust in God's unlimited store of resources, of abilities, and of power? God's greatest gift, the greatest provision he has given us, is the gift of his everlasting spiritual life because of his Son. It comes by our belief in Jesus as God's Son and our Savior. God provides this to us in order to accomplish his greatest purpose, which is our loving relationship with him that will never end. Lizzie York Case wrote this line, "There is no unbelief. Whoever plants a seed beneath the sod and waits to see it push away the clod, he trusts in God." There's things that we do almost intuitively, automatically, unthinkingly, because we trust that the outcome will be the same over and over and over, don't we? And actually what we're saying is, I trust that God, who created all of this, will make this happen again and again and again, like clockwork, because that's what God does. We need to trust him in the same way to provide for us to do his will. Do you trust in God? Do you trust him to provide? Do you need to correct your relationship with God in any way? Do you trust Him with your life? If we can be of help to you tonight in any way, come forward right now as we stand and sing.